This is the third part of our series on generosity. We're talking about being generous, living a life worth giving. And I don't want you to worry if you miss the first 2 weeks, because you could still understand what we're saying today. And also, you can go to our app, where you could follow along right now and take notes if you have our app. You can listen to the previous messages there. You can go online to our website. You can even go to iTunes. It's pretty cool. You can search my name and you'll find our podcast, which, you know, I don't know what that really means, but since there are millions of podcasts out there now, but you can catch up with the things we've been talking about over these last couple weeks, because what we're trying to do here, and what I'm captivated by, what has my heart and has my interest in, and what gets me up in the morning, is this idea that we could build a radically different kind of community here, built on the gospel of Jesus Christ. A community of people who are generous in every way with each other because of the generosity we've received from God through Jesus. A community that stands out in a world that is always grasping and grabbing because we are radically generous. And over these last couple weeks, we've already learned that generosity, like I said, is about more than money. Money is one form of currency, right, that we use to trade value. But there are many types of currency that we have in life. There are many currencies of life. So you could be generous with your money, but still not be radically generous because you withhold yourself relationally from people. You'll give tons of money to missionaries, but you'll never go and sit with people somewhere who are lost. So maybe you're financially generous, but you're not radically generous because you're withholding relationally. Or maybe you're withholding your time or your energy. Radical generosity, we've said, is pervasive. It touches every part of my life and your life, all of the currencies of our lives. Last week, we looked at relational generosity. And today, we're going to look at another currency of life where Jesus challenges us to be generous. We're going to look at our hospitality, the way we share our resources with others. Hospitality is an unusual word. You hear it, you probably think of all the homemaking shows on TV. I want you to forget that, and we're going to kind of blow that definition open. Hospitality is a much bigger thing than that. And so without a doubt, though, in our world, hospitality is a form of currency. It is used around the world to assign value to people. We use it in our lives to assign value to people, who we invite into our homes, who we don't, who we take out to dinner, who we don't, who we'll go to dinner with, and who we won't go to dinner with, who we'll accept invitations from. Hospitality is a currency of life that is used all around the world to gain something. We use hospitality to get ahead. You may call it networking, but it's still the same thing. And we can use it, hospitality, either selfishly or we can use it generously. And Jesus understood that, and that's why he challenged our ideas about hospitality at a dinner where he was invited to. There are three parts to the story we're going to look at today from Luke chapter 14. And we'll take them one at a time, but let me just tell you the three parts before we jump in. Part one is going to be Jesus talking about guests and warning about the enticement of the inner circle. Part two is going to be Jesus talking about hosts and teaching the principle of the open home. And then part three is Jesus talking about us and our participation in the great celebration supper that God is preparing, which is a theme throughout Scripture that it uses to talk about the day of our Lord when he makes all things new and sets all things right, and new creation begins finally and completely free from sin and suffering and death. So part one is warning about the inner circle and the lure of it. Part two is about the open home. And part three is our place in this feast that God is planning. So let's look at part one, the inner circle. Look at Luke chapter 14. It's in your bulletin. It's on the screen. It's in the app. You can follow along and take notes there. Luke chapter 14, verses 7 through 11. This is what he says. When Jesus noticed how the guests at this dinner picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. He said, "When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come to you and say, 'Give this person your seat.' Then, humiliated, you'll have to get up and take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he'll say to you, 'Friend, move up to a better place.' Then you'll be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. We've got four weddings so far scheduled for this year, and one of the hardest things about weddings is figuring out who is going to sit where with the guests at the reception, right? Who do you invite? But then who sits where? Who sits with whom? How close do they sit to the front, to the dais, and how far away? Do close friends get a place before distant cousins? Who goes where? And if you walked into a Middle Eastern wedding feast in Jesus' day, what you'd find is that everyone is seated based on how close they were relationally to the bride and groom. You actually knew where you stood. So picture like a setting like this, where, you know, the bride and groom and everybody, the important hosts, sit at the middle table. And then everyone else gets to know where they are relationally based on how close they sit. Ingenious, isn't it? Have you ever been in a wedding like that and you get sat at the back where all the kids are? And you're like, oh, never going to their wedding again. So in this story that Jesus tells, there's no fancy place cards. There's no rocks with calligraphy names on them. None of that stuff. You walk in and you have to pick a seat. And so wouldn't it be wiser to pick a seat that, because you don't know who's invited for sure. So wouldn't it be wiser to just pick a seat that's further down the table and then have someone come to you than to pick a seat that's closer and then have to be told, sorry, Uncle Harold sits here. You go sit at the other end of this table. And that just would be embarrassing. This seems like it's just plain old good advice from Jesus. But it's so much more than just plain old good advice. Jesus is illustrating a principle that we've come across already a few times in the last couple weeks. And if you're watching, maybe you caught it right there in verse 11, the very closing part of that parable. All those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Over and over in these encounters Jesus has in the Gospel of Luke, the dividing line between those who are approved by God and those who are disapproved by God is the line drawn between humility and pride. Not between good and bad, or between the haves and the have-nots, but between those who are humble enough to realize their spiritual poverty and those who are too proud to see it. And Jesus sitting there watching everyone, watching this play out, and everyone grabs seats and then maybe get moved up or down. He puts his thumb right on this struggle that we have, this desire to be in the inner circle. Whether it's, you know, right from when we're kids, being picked for sports in school or invited to a certain kid's party or brought into a special task force at work or promoted into the management group at work, we have this drive to be in an inner circle. And we may call it networking, but it's this drive to get into. If I'm in a circle, I want to get into the next better circle. This drive, this enticement of the inner circle. It's no surprise Google named their social media thing circles, right? Because they understood how we want to get into circles. And so there's all kinds of circles that you have in your life. And your circles, the things that attract you, the inner circles you want to get into, they may not be the ones I want to get into. But the thing we share in common is we all have this desire to be in an inner circle. Even if it's, and some of you are thinking this right now, even if it's being in the inner circle of people who think inner circles are stupid, you want to be in that place. And that drives us to be relationally selfish, to use hospitality in order to promote and advance ourselves. Because there's this enticement of being the acceptance of an inner circle. And the irony is that if we use relationships selfishly to get acceptance and to get brought into the inner circles, we're less likely to be accepted. But if you enter into relationships generously, in order to love people, regardless of what you get back, you're likely to find the affirmation and the acceptance that others are craving for and clinging at. Beware of the enticement of the inner circle in your life. It will cause you to use hospitality selfishly to pick and choose who you want to spend time with based on what they can give you and what they can do for you instead of out of generous love. Pride will lead you to use hospitality to promote yourself and to use others' hospitality to advance yourself. Jesus saw that, knew it, called it what it was. And while that may work with people, it will not work with God. So don't be lured by the desire for the inner circle. It'll never be what you're hoping for it to be. Instead, embrace humility and you'll find yourself standing with Jesus. That's part one, the enticement of the inner circle. Part two, Jesus turns his attention now to hosts and teaches this principle of the open home. Do you know how to get fired in a political campaign? Say you were a campaign manager. What would it take to get you fired? Probably something like, you know, you organize rallies where you only invite poor people and homeless people and sick people to come. No wealthy people or people of influence, and no media either. Just poor people, sick people, homeless people, people who don't have much, and no cameras, because that's just the good thing to do, right? It would be nice for the politician to just get to know those people. That would instantly get you fired, because that's not the way it works, right? Who do you, if you're running a political campaign, what do? You throw $1,000 plate dinners plus for wealthy people, people of influence, people who can throw some weight around and negotiate deals so that you can have money so you can buy ads that can talk about all the nice things you want to do for poor, sick, homeless people. That's the way it works in politics. And for most of the people living in Jesus' day, that's the way life worked as well. They lived in this hierarchical society where everything was stratified. And it was all about trying to get into that next level. And the way you would do that is you would invite people into your home and hope you could get someone who was a next level up to come into your home. Because then, if they accept your invitation, they have to now invite you back into their home where you get to rub shoulders with their wealthy friends and move up the ladder. And say, well, why would they even come to dinner at your house if they know you're below them? Well, they would do it because, you know, they see in you maybe a chance to spread some influence, and then they invite you to their house, and they can show all their friends how, look how many people I'm influencing, you know, all these people I've brought into my home. And then you get to rub shoulders, and you get to move up the ladder, and before you know it, you're getting higher and higher because you're just networking, right? And that was life. That was life, and that's how everyone used hospitalities. That's how hosts used hospitalities. You know who never got invited to dinners like this? Homeless people or sick people, people who were poor. Do you know why? Because they couldn't reciprocate. Even if they were invited, they couldn't accept it, because if you couldn't reciprocate and bring them into your home, well, then you couldn't accept an invitation into theirs. And so those people are left out and kept away. The same way sometimes, have you ever like not accepted an invitation to go to someone's house because then you'd have to invite them to yours and you're kind of embarrassed because your house is small or it's dirty, your husband does a bad job at cleaning the bathroom, right? Anything ever felt that way? Like, oh, then I'll have to invite them. So many of us feel that way. We go with life groups, say, oh, invite people into your home. And they're like, oh, I don't want to bring them in my home. And, you know, we got to clean up and everything. We get this thing inside of us where we hold back. We don't want to bring people in. And so Jesus, he looks at this whole system of only invite people out and only invite people into your home who can do something for you. And he turns it on his head and he tells them to reject this entire system of living that they're in, they were born in, that it's all they know. Starting in verse 12, Jesus says to his host, the one who invited him, he says, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your sisters or your relatives or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you've been repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you'll be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you'll be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Now, before some of you get either too upset or too happy about not being able to invite relatives over for dinner, we should recognize that this is an idiom. What's an idiom? An idiom is a way we use language non-literally to represent something. So if I said it's raining cats and dogs, you wouldn't go outside thinking a dog's going to fall on your head. What would you think? It's raining hard. Right, it's really raining bad. It's an idiom. Actions speak louder than words. Elvis has left the building. That's the last straw. Those are ways we use language non-literally to communicate a point. So Jesus uses idioms regularly, and it's important to pay attention. He's not saying you can't invite relatives over. Jesus uses idioms in other places. At one point he says that in order to follow him, we must love him and hate father, mother, sister, brother. He's not saying literally you should hate your family. What he's saying is that our love for him, that in comparison to our love for him, everything else should just pale. That's what he's communicating there. That our love for him should be greater than our love for anyone or anything else. And so here Jesus is communicating a point. He doesn't mean we should never invite family and relatives and rich neighbors over. He's telling us that Christian hospitality, though, is a radically different thing than what we're used to. Jesus is saying that Christian hospitality is primarily for the poor and the broken, the stranger. And at this point, you usually ask three questions, and I'm going to borrow, Tim Keller summarizes these this way. He says, what is Christian hospitality is the first question. What is it supposed to be and look like? Who is it exactly for then? And three, why should we do this? So what Christian hospitality is. A few weeks ago, I had bronchitis, and I was at home sick, and I was on a telemarket chat, chat for help for something, and I'm talking to the person who's on the other side of the world, and in this chat, and they're like, the obligatory, well, how are you today, sir? And I said, I typed back, home, comma, sick, but otherwise okay. And they replied back to me, it's never easy being away from home. I thought, no, there's a comma there. That means I'm just home, at sick, but I'm home. But it struck me that this person's on the other end of the world, but they know that feeling. Have you ever been homesick? You just want to be back where you grew up because home is that place of refuge, that place of refreshment, that place where we have our own bed, our own chair, our own bathroom. They're the places we go to for warmth and for comfort, for escape. That's what home is, where I get restored and refreshed before I head back out into this crazy world. Especially living in a city, the home becomes this refuge. So here's what hospitality is. Christian hospitality is refreshing others with the things you normally use to refresh yourself. Hospitality is inviting people into your living space, your home, and refreshing them with your resources. Those things that you normally use to refresh and restore and relax yourself. The things that you long for when you're separated from them. That's what Christian hospitality is. Who is it for? Well, the answer, simply, is strangers. Hospitality is treating strangers as family. The word hospitality in Greek literally means the love of strangers. And in a world of stranger danger, we have a hard time putting this together. And so the next question you'll ask, okay, well, what kind of strangers? And so three answers to that. One, everyone look around. Just look around the room. You don't get much stranger than the people you're looking at right now, do you? Right here in this room, I mean, you just look around this place, there are a lot of people you don't know. And so, first of all, let's start here. You're in a church, you're part of a church where there's enough people and enough different people, and then we've got multiple services through the day in different languages. There are opportunities galore to meet strangers within the family of God here. And the Bible, the New Testament, is constantly exhorting us to show hospitality to one another. And so you can invite a new person probably every weekend for the rest of this year and still not get through all the strangers who are in this place. So it starts right here. In our house, inviting people who are part of the family of God. And they're only strangers because you don't know them yet. That's what a stranger is. Second, neighbors, people who are next door to you or who live in the same building as you, or coworkers. They may not believe the things you believe, and you may not believe anything they believe, but so what? Invite them into your home and show them love. Read through the Gospels and see all the times Jesus catches heat for spending time with the people who were moral outsiders. And he wasn't doing it because he wanted to be accepted by them or become like them. He did it because he loved them and he knew that this was the way to love them into the kingdom. You don't scold them into the kingdom. You don't chastise them into the kingdom. You love them into the kingdom, into belief. Hospitality is for believers who don't know yet, and it's for neighbors who don't think the way you do, but so what? Go to them, invite them into your home, take them out to eat. And then lastly, it's for the poor. Don't miss the main point Jesus is making here. It's our responsibility to give preference to the poor and the hurting. Not just to throw money into a benevolence offering once a month, or to, you know, hand them a bag of food once a week, or a jacket when it gets cold. Jesus is saying the poor are our primary responsibility, the primary target of our hospitality. Those who are hurting and broken, sick and infirmed, they're the ones who are the primary target of our hospitality. And that's not easy. I know for me, if you're anything like me, home is my refuge. I leave home and I'm talking with people all the time who are hurting and going through issues and nonstop, you know, questions and talking and answering. And I go home and it's like, you know, fortress of solitude. Shut it down. Turn off the phone. Close everything. And then I sit there and I hear Jesus whispering, "Are you comfortable? Nice. Aren't you glad you've got this place? Why don't you go share it with someone who doesn't have what you have here?" And that might tempt you to react, it does for me, angrily and or guiltily. But what I've found is that when I humble myself and actually obey, I find a deeper joy in that obedience and in sharing and hospitality than I ever get in hoarding it to myself. Because that generosity frees me from narcissism, from the self-obsession and from pride. It frees me from magnifying my troubles and minimizing other people's problems. I learn the freedom of generosity when I obey. Generous hospitality is refreshing people from your home, with your home, the things you normally use to refresh yourself. And it's for strangers. But why do it? Why should we do this? Why practice hospitality? And here's why. So God can turn strangers into friends. Hebrews 13:2 says, "Do not forget to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing so, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it." And he's talking about a story from way back in Genesis 18 when Abraham has three strangers walk up to him and he brings them in and he cooks a meal for them, and it turns out it's God and two angels. You invite only the people whom you choose because you know they're safe and fun and they make you feel good about yourself, and maybe they give you something and help you advance your life, your place in church, or your career. Then you're right back to that radically ungenerous life of grasping, acting as though you own what you have, and ignoring the fact that no, we are all guests of God in this world, not the owners. We are guests who are called to share the hospitality that is being shown to us. In all of life, God is the host, and we're beneficiaries of his hospitality. He's the real host. And sometimes he turns strangers into friends. How did you get the friends you have? Ever think about that? Think about the people in your life who are your friends. And then listen to something that C.S. Lewis wrote in his book, The Four Loves. It's a long quote, so focus in on this. He says, "In friendship, we think we have chosen our peers. In reality, a few years difference in the date of our births, a few more miles between certain houses, the choice of one university instead of another, the accident of a topic being raised or not raised at a first meeting, any of these chances might have kept us apart. But for a Christian, there are, strictly speaking, no chances. A secret master of ceremonies has been at work. Christ, who said to the disciples, 'You haven't chosen me, but I have chosen you,' can truly say to every group of Christian friends, 'You haven't chosen one another, I have chosen you for one another.' The friendship is not a reward for our discrimination and good taste in finding one another. It is the instrument by which God reveals to each the beauties of all the others. By friendship, God opens our eyes to those beauties. They are, like all beauties, derived from him, and then, in a good friendship, increased by him through the friendship itself, so that it is his instrument for creating as well as for revealing." Now think about those friendships and give thanks to God for them and the way he orchestrates our lives. Why would we show generous hospitality, sharing our homes with strangers? Because God will turn some of them into friends, and others may very well be angels whom he is sending to minister mercy and grace to us. Are you with me? Part one was the danger of the inner circle and how it entices us and causes us to use others to climb ourselves. Part two was about the open home, how and why and with whom we should practice generous hospitality. And Jesus drives it all home with this third part of the parable. And this is where the power to practice generous hospitality comes from, because this is not easy. We sang that song about going out into the dangerous waves. Showing hospitality this way, generous hospitality to strangers out of just love, not any kind of self-interest, is like jumping out into an ocean of waves. It is scary. He makes us brave. And here's how. Listen to the story he tells. Verse 15. When one of those at the table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, "Oh, blessed." I picture this guy as drunk when he says this. "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in the kingdom." I can't do a drunk voice. I've never been drunk in my life. So I'll just do normal. "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." Jesus replied, "A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything is ready.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, 'I've just bought some property, a field. I must go and see it. Please excuse me.' Another said, 'I just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me.' Still another said, 'I've just got married. There's no way I can come. She ain't let me out.' The servant came back and reported to his master and told him what these guys had said. And then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, 'Go out quickly into the streets and the alleys of town and bring the poor and the crippled, the blind and the lame.' And he said, 'Sir, we've done what you ordered, but there's still room.' And he said, the master tells the servant, 'Go out to the roads, the country lanes, and compel them to come in, so that my house may be full. I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet.'" So much going on in that parable. And we're really just going to scratch the surface this morning. But it is from this that we derive all the power we need and the strength we need and the encouragement and the motivation we need to practice this brave hospitality, this generous hospitality. So, as so often happens at parties, some guy throws out some inane comment thinking that he's with Jesus, but he's not. Jesus has been challenging this entire way of life, right? Don't climb social ladders when you're a guest. Don't only invite people. And that makes this guy think, oh yeah, God's going to invite us all to a feast. Isn't it going to be awesome when we all get to go there, because we're all good, obviously. We're all doing well, obviously. So God's going to accept us in. And this guy is picturing, when he says this, what it says in Isaiah 25, where the prophet pictures of death being swallowed up and this veil between us and God torn apart and everything removed, and we get invited into this rich feast. That's what the prophet Isaiah talked about, this rich feast where we'll celebrate salvation, final and ultimate and true, new life, new creation. So Jesus looks at this guy, raises an eyebrow, and he didn't say this exactly, but I feel like this is behind there. "You really assume you're going to be there? Interesting. Let me tell you about who's there and who's not." And then he tells this parable. Because most people you talk to, ask them, what's going to happen when you die? And anyone who believes there's more to life than just this and die and then nothing, they assume there's something better, something good, and they're going to be there. Why? Because I'm pretty good. I take care of my family. I'm a nice guy. I don't really break any laws. Don't break any rules. I have this sense that I am making it. I'm doing okay. Most people, we have that same idea that this guy had, that yeah, I think I'm doing well enough. Whatever it is, I should be accepted in. And Jesus tells this story to just obliterate that way of thinking. So let's look at the parable a little bit. Let's break it apart. Who is throwing the feast? Who's the owner? It's God. God invites these people to the feast. Who's invited to the feast? You get a picture of a few of them. Have you ever paid attention to them and what they're like? They're all doing well. They all have things in common. They're respectable people who are taking care of life. And each one, in fact, is preoccupied with a good thing that is happening in their life, and it's leading them to have no time for God. And these three things that they're preoccupied with are all good things. They're the same three things that we're all preoccupied with. So what was the first one? He had just gotten a piece of property, a home that he's got to set up. The second guy got some equipment for his work. He's got to go make sure it works. I got to take care of my job. The last guy is married. He's got to take care of his wife and family. Can't leave. All the same three things that we all get obsessed with and focus on for creating home for ourselves. The signs we use to indicate how we're doing in life. Do I have a home? What's my home like? How's my job? How's my family? How's my home? How's my job? How's my family? Can I get a better home? Can I get a better job? Can I get a better family? Right? Well, there they are, busy creating their places of security and refuge and restoration, proud of what they're building, and they look down on God's invitation. This is, what they do is incredibly insulting, because they get the save the date. They have that. They know when it is. But then when the time comes, they're like, oh, sorry, I didn't hold the invitation. So they're being rude to God. They're rejecting God's hospitality because they don't think it has much value to them and their life. And so what does God do? He sends out his servants into the city streets. Bring in the poor, the homeless, and the crippled, and then that's not enough. So what does he do? He sends them out into the countryside. Get them and bring them in. Until my house is filled with these people. And he doesn't invite them. Why? Because they couldn't accept an invitation. They don't qualify to be invited because they couldn't reciprocate. He's like, compel them to come in. You don't need to be qualified. Just hear my call, humble yourself, and come. And so in the end of this story, prompted by this maybe drunk guy who assumes that he and all these other very well-to-do people are going to get in, who actually ends up in the feast, in God's feast? Not the people who built lives they could be proud of with nice homes and families and careers. Not the people you'd expect, but the poor in spirit. Last summer, we talked about being poor in spirit a lot, and you can go back and listen to those messages. But I'm going to paraphrase a way that Tim Keller talked about it. He said, when it comes to God's offering of salvation, there are two classes of people, the poor in spirit and the middle class in spirit. The poor in spirit recognize that they have nothing in the bank. The middle class in spirit think they've got a little something there in the bank. And so they don't value God's invitation because I think I'm doing okay. The poor in spirit, they see that there's nothing. They see that even the good they do is tainted. And they realize that even the things they do that are might others might think would get them credit, it's tainted by selfishness, by ulterior motives. They see their imperfection. And once again, it comes down to this. In the kingdom of heaven, it is the humble who are accepted and the proud who are left out. And don't miss that point. You could be rich and be poor in spirit. It's much harder. And you could be poor and be middle class in spirit. It's not about what you have. It's about, are you poor in spirit or are you middle class in spirit or upper class in spirit? Do you recognize how much you need God and his invitation, that without it you are lost? Do you see that? And do you humble yourself or are you still clinging to your pride? So when it comes to God's feast and who's in and who's out, none of the things we typically value matter. Houses, jobs, family. All that matters is that we are poor in spirit, humble before God, confessing our sin and receiving his invitation for forgiveness. Verse 11, for all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. And that should encourage you and me. Because no matter where you're coming from, God came looking for us. This is about us. Jesus came to God's chosen people, Israel, and there they are rejecting him, looking down on this invitation from God. And so the invitation goes out into the city streets and then beyond, around the world. That's what Jesus is talking about here, so that you and I can be here 2,000 years later, the other side of the planet, hearing this good news and having an opportunity once more to respond to it and have our lives changed by it. You and I can walk into the feast that God is preparing. How does this happen? How can this possibly be free? How can we not have to fight and scratch our way into some inner circle to get there, clawing and grabbing? How can the greatest thing that we could ever imagine come to us free? And this is how. Think about Jesus and what he did. Jesus was in the greatest inner circle ever, right? The Trinity. There he is enjoying ultimate power, ultimate joy, ultimate love, infinite unity in every way. The ultimate inner circle, there Jesus is, and he steps down into earth and puts aside all his rights. And he comes, steps out of that inner circle and comes here. And when he came to earth, he didn't come owning property. He didn't come as the owner of a business. He didn't even come with a family, a wife. He had no place to lay his head. He was homeless. And when he was ultimately killed, he was taken outside the city, an outcast, and murdered in complete and utter shame. You could not push someone out of the circle any harder than Jesus was pushed out, or cast them further than he was cast. Jesus' life and death are the greatest acts of generosity, of generous hospitality you will ever see. Jesus Christ, the ultimate insider, becomes an outsider so that you and I can be brought in. And that hospitality had an incredible cost, but he is incredibly generous. And because he's the ultimate homeless man, he is now the ultimate host. Because of his grace, you and I can become part of his family and be there in that feast. And that home is waiting for you. And all the power and all the strength and all the courage that you and I need to stand up and be generous and show this kind of generous hospitality comes from Jesus, from the grace and the hospitality that he has shown you and me. God showed it to you through Jesus. Let that inspire your hospitality. Let it empower your radical generosity so that you can begin to be and show this generous hospitality to people at work, people within the church who you don't know, and to the stranger, the poor, the broken, the hurting, the sick, who God brings across your path. Let him break you free from the enticement of that social climbing and that desire to get into inner circles. Let him be your model for how to open your home for strangers, the broken and hurting. And let him set you free from wasting chunks of your life chasing the elusive lie that just a little bit more will make this place a home and a place of refuge. It won't. The best you can do as you pour your time into your career and into your house and into family, the best thing you can do is create a cheap substitute for what God has for you and what God can create as a family for you and as a home for you. If we would humble ourselves and accept that in him. This morning, I want to give you 7 practical ways that you and I can take this and go out and do it. All right, so just 7 ways you and I can start to do this. And we can maybe give us some handles so we know what should I do to begin to practice. Because that's what the Bible says in Romans 12. Practice hospitality. Practice it because it takes work. Practice hospitality. So number one, worship team, you can start to come up. Number one, invite your neighbors into your home for a meal or out to eat. And if God is doing something in that relationship, then invite them to church. Invite them to your small group. Just invite them into your home, though, first. Just to be with them. Just to know them. How are they? Who are they? And then you sense God doing something, then invite them that next step and they come into church with you. Come into your small group with you. That's number one. Number two, invite someone in the church who you don't know. You could do that today. Before you leave this place, find someone you don't know and invite them in. Those of you who have more space in your homes, invite people who have less space in their homes. Why did God give you a home with a lot of space? Yeah, God gave you that home. Why did he give it to you? So you could fill it with people. Be generous with your hospitality. God gave you that place. And if you've been here for a longer time, if you've been around this church for a while, find new people and invite them into your home. You take the first step and invite them in. Find the new ones and bring them in. Invite them in. And if they're new to town, then help them figure out how does life work in Boston where none of the streets make any sense. Right? Help them find out where's the best place to shop, where's the best supermarket, who has the best prices, the best stuff. Invest. This is generous. And you're starting to think, oh my goodness, there's so much time. How can I do this? You do for the one what you wish you could do for the many. Let God put someone in your path and then show them this generous hospitality. Number three, host your life group in your home. Some of you are meeting here at the church, and that's wonderful, but you know what? Say, you know what? Hey, why don't you all come to my house next time? And let's cram into your living room, or maybe you've got the big house. Fine, everyone spread out in your living room. Invite them into your home. That's a special place. Share what God's given you there to refresh them. Number four, every month when we receive our benevolence offering, give into that benevolence offering. We talked about how we were celebrating the 90th anniversary of that last month. And at first, it was the middle of the Depression, and everyone was just giving like a dime. If you just had a dime, it was give a dime for our church. What a heritage we have of caring. And there are people in our church who are hurting and who need help, who need financial help, and that's a way that we can show hospitality. You give to that benevolence fund, it helps our deacons meet the needs of people in our church who are hurting. Number five, with me? Number five, volunteer for the food pantry, going to get food or give out food, or for the clothing closet, or any of the community things we do to show hospitality. Volunteer and show up and say, I'm here to help, what can I do? You can always use more people there. Number six, become one of our ushers or greeters or cafe workers. One of the people who, when others walk into the church, they see your beautiful smiling face. No? And as you welcome them in. And then when we say on Sundays, hey, turn around and say hello, don't just be like, yeah, nice to see you. Don't do that. Take time. Hi. How are you? Wait for me to say, okay, everybody, shut up. She's my sister, so this probably feels weird for her. I know you. Take time to connect face to face, eye to eye. How are you? How are you? And then when we break, we're going to sing a song and then break here. And I'm just going to challenge you to show hospitality to the people around you. Take some moments. Look them in the face. Look them in the eyes. Shake their hand. And hold for a few moments. Be generous with your hospitality. Because God has been so generous to us.